This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Zach Moore. Ken Tripp is still off filming the Green Berets, but we have a very exciting interview this week with writer Will Stape. His recent book, Star Trek Sex, Analyzing the Most Sexually Charged Episodes of the Original Series, is a unique examination of sexuality as portrayed through the 1960s broadcast television lens of the Original Series, and I'm excited to discuss it with him today. Welcome to the podcast, Will.
Hey, Zach, what's up? How you doing?
Good, man, good.
No, I had a comment, though, when you said about, you know, your buddy doing the Green Berets. That's the name of one of my favorite old Western movies or war movies, the Green Berets. What is he doing? That's really cool.
So that is just a reference to me. I usually have our co-host here, Ken Tripp.
Okay.
He's not with me this week. He's been a couple weeks now. So that's a little in-joke I say when he's not here, that he's off filming the Green Berets because in the original series, George Takei left the show for a while to go film the Green Berets, and then
absolutely,
Walter Koenig came
in. That's why I brought it up. Yeah. I know. That's great.
Walter
awesome.
Koenig came in and took
over. I get the reference now. That's awesome.
There you go, man. See, a true Trek fan connecting the dots. So
I'm telling you. And it's a great film, and, you know, like, Takei, needless to say, he's had a storied career. I mean, it's so awesome, you know, to be with, you know, such a big film, John Wayne and all.
It's like, I'm sure he misses being on Star Trek as many episodes as he did, but how can you know, look poorly upon being in a film with John Wayne at the height of his career, right?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I remember that, you know, because I've done a lot of interviews myself. I interviewed Nana Visitor, you know, good old Kira from Deep Space Nine, and I was asking about when Terry Farrell left the show, you know, to do the Becker sitcom. And I said, you know, did you guys discuss, you know, because they were, of course, friends and all. And she said, yeah, she really made the right decision. I said, did Terry maybe have regrets? And she said, no, she wanted to work with Ted Danson and be in a big sitcom. So
and
that's neat.
Not to get too off topic, but I actually liked that change in season 7. Actually, if there's one character you can switch out, Dax is the perfect one. So it just all those real world factors just kind of work for the story, in my opinion. But
And I'm not ashamed to admit I had more than a tear in my eye when Dax, you know, bit it courtesy of Golden Kai. I swear it was awesome. Yeah, it's a memorable one.
We'll get into Deep Space Nine and Next Gen a little later, Will, because you have some connections there as well. But before we dive into all that and then talking about your book, let's talk a little bit about your Star Trek fandom, all that good stuff. So when did you discover the show? What are some of your earliest Star Trek memories? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's incredible. I put in the book, I remember talking to my publisher and editors, you know, when I was working on it, and it was just like, you know, let's get a bit of background on this fandom. And I can clearly remember 4 years old. I was not in grammar school yet, was not even in kindergarten, no finger paints even, you know. It was 4 years old, and I'm watching my little black and white, you know, non-cable, non-Roku TV back in the day, and I remember the episode, the scene, the dialogue. It was Squire of Gothos, good old Trelane, and, you know, dancing with the yeoman. And like, my little four-year-old brain was like, what is this? It was just, like, exploding. And, and I kind of never looked back. I mean, I didn't become a regular, you know, viewer then, but I would try to watch whenever possible. And, you know, here we are now. Yeah. It's such an impression.
It's crazy how much just our assimilation of media has changed in the last, 10, 20, even 30 years, right? Because you see a little bit of Star Trek on TV when you're a kid. You catch it while you can, that kind of thing. But today, it's like, oh, You want to watch Star Trek? Well, here's the entirety of Star Trek you can watch at your disposal at any time, any place.
It's crazy. I remember even before, you know, CBS Paramount did, now they're doing CBS All Access, of course, you know, it's on Netflix. What is it? I think it's on Hulu. It's pretty much on every, I guess, streaming. But I remember they used to just put it on their, like, CBS.com, like back in the ancient days of maybe, you know, 8 years ago. And, yeah, and I would catch up. I would, you know, watch it there. Or I think StarTrek.com has a couple episodes, too, right? So you just literally can go in so many places, right?
Right. Yeah, no, I'm similar. I watched Star Trek at a young age, and my parents were actually both Trekkies, so I had no hope. I was a Star Trek fan.
Yeah, it was a total doom, blessing, or curse. That's awesome. I love it.
And here I am doing a Star Trek podcast, so...
It's great, Zach. You know, and I'm just the opposite. Literally no one in my family likes Star Trek. They run the other way. You know, like I had to actually, like, you know, bribe them to sit down to watch my episode. Like, please. So, no, I have no comrades in Trek them in my family. So,
well, one of your other big fandoms is the Howard Stern show. You're a big fan of Howard Stern and his show. So definitely. how did that influence your, well, I know it had some factors in just you in general, but Star Trek fandom and all that good stuff.
Sure. In fact, it's so cool because for years, you know, Howard talked about, still does, that he's a huge sci-fi geek, you know, comic book geek, and he loves Star Trek. And so, I mean, I remember, you know, in the early days, I'm talking about like late 80s, early 90s when I first started, you know, listening to him. He's just one of those celebs that, you know, not only loves the show and says it, but he can prove it. You know, he'll talk about, you know, the Klingon honor ceremony, whatever. He knows his stuff. Yeah, it's good. It's great.
You're so right about that. He doesn't just talk the talk, but he actually can back it up. Because I think there's so many people today, because we've had this nerd renaissance, this geek renaissance, call it what you will, and everybody is like a nerd now, right? It's like, oh, yeah, I watch Star Wars. Yeah. I'm like, well, okay, well, who doesn't, right?
Yeah, but do you know what a blue lightsaber and a green or the power jewel, right? Can you actually give us real details? I know, that's the true geek in there, right?
Now, I'm not a big Howard Stern fan or anything, but I'm, of course, familiar with him. He's just a pop culture icon at this point. And I went to a convention a few years ago, and George Takei was there, and he talked about the origin of the "oh my" meme. A lot of people don't know that's from Howard Stern is where that originated.
Absolutely. And it's amazing. And I remember listening live. It's so cool to evoke these memories. I remember listening live when they did, like, the phony phone call to George Takei. Well, it might have been taped, but, you know, they were broadcasting live anyway. And you hear, you know, the guys pretending they're Ricardo Montalban. And it was just, and they did it perfectly. And he really fell for it. And then, of course, he got mad and there was kind of a bit of a war, but then there was a truce. And now he's, of course, a part of the big family, an official member. He was just on the other day. I think he does at least a day a week or a couple of days a month. Yeah.
Wow.
And he'll stay on almost the whole half of the show or more than an hour. Yeah.
That's awesome.
And to turn it around again, because he was pretty, you know, hurt by it, or, you know, he was offended at the time. But I don't know, you know, it was months or a year or two. But, he just flipped it. He totally turned it around and became, and I'm sure Howard talked to him and said, hey, we're just having fun and you should come on board. And yeah, it's beautiful. It's one of those entertainment stories that is just special. It's a really special, cool thing. Yeah.
Now, being a Howard Stern fan and then writing this book about Star Trek sexuality, there are obviously some ties there. Right. So how did that, was that something that, like, sparked your move to write this book, to examine the show this way?
Oh, Zach, it's incredible. This is basically what happened. I was doing a lot of freelance writing, a lot of magazines, online sites. So I was writing for actually a site called Associated Content, and then Yahoo acquired them, Yahoo News, whatever. So it was under that whole big banner. So I would do a lot of, you know, stuff that I love, and Star Trek remains, you know, something I love. So I do a lot of Star Trek articles. And then a good friend of mine, he was like, you know, Will, I guess 50 Shades of Grey had just come out. You know, it was like a huge, you know, the book. And I'm like, yeah. And he said something about, you know, sexuality. I said, well, Peter, you know, his name is Peter. I said, Peter, well, I did do like an article on sexuality of Trek already. He goes, but why don't you, like, kind of ramp it up, you know, do more like sort of like bondage, whatever. And I'm like, I guess I could find certain episodes or certain. And lo and behold, yeah, I started looking over. So then I wrote just like a little article, you know, like the sexuality of Next Gen or old series of Deep Space Nine, whatever. And then one day I'm listening to Howard and they started teasing Robin, you know, Robin Quivers, his great sidekick, starting teasing her about having Klingon sex or like when she would go on dates, like, oh, you know, blah, blah. And they start talking in Klingon and teasing her about, like, you know, her sex with her dates like Klingons. And I'm like, this is too, you know, gift from the heavens. And I'm like, it all clicked. You know, the light bulb just went off. I said, I got to do a book on Star Trek sex. So. Yeah. So I really do owe a lot to Howard and my friend Peter, and they both kind of motivated me. It was like, and then rewriting for, you know, for online stuff. And don't you find too, like when you do posts or articles, whatever, like, you know, you want to put all your all into it and something you love. And again, sci-fi and Star Trek, you know, not necessarily in that order, but pretty close, is something close to my heart. I just love science fiction. I love Star Trek.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So let's get down to it. You know, the book itself, you examine about 40 episodes or adventures, you know, counting the movies of the original series. How did you come to narrow it down to those particular episodes? Like what was the criteria of that?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, and I do kind of regret. I'd say there's maybe four or five offhand. I could say maybe Piece of the Action, Shore Leave, and Cloud Minders. Those were ones, you know, I just was going to put them in, but they just didn't kind of jazz me enough. You know, and again, the subtitle, the official title is Sexually Charged. So I tried to go, you know, for the real sort of gusto and the real, you know, sex. And so, yeah, and so that's what I did. I basically went over every episode just like, in a wiki or memory alpha, just scanning it quick because I know them so well. I mean, Zach, I'm sure you can relate. Like, literally, like, I just know I've seen each one like dozens of times. So I'm like, blah, 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 you know, plot points, blah, blah, blah. And then I watched maybe a few scenes. Yeah, I did watch a couple, maybe full episodes or full scenes. And that's, you know, that's how I did the research, the initial research. You had to pick that. But it was kind of hard, right? Even, you know, some people in reviews or, you know, other interviews said, why didn't you pick like Shore Leave? Why didn't you pick this? I'm like, well, it just didn't jazz me enough, you know, sorry.
That's what, that was going to be my next question. Were there any that didn't make the cut? But you already tackled that. The Cloud Miners especially reminds me because it's like Spock is so out of character in that episode. You know, coming on to a Drock scene, and he's like, oh,
Drock scene, I love it. Exactly.
Never met a work of art or something like that, right? He's just, what are you doing, man?
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And the more you say it, the more I regret. No, I didn't put it. No, it was. I think that was really one of the ones. Yeah, it was. And I think, though, but again, at the end, it wasn't sexually charged. But then, like we're saying, you could make the argument that because of Spock's, you know, the Vulcan heritage and his restraint, that in a way it is a very classical or cool example of it. So there you go. Volume 2, second edition.
Volume 2. Let's get it.
There you go. Definitely.
Did you have any preconceptions about sexuality in TOS that were confirmed or actually challenged as you took a deeper look at these episodes? Because, you know, for example, I'm thinking of the pop culture stereotype of Kirk, right? He's like, he's sleeping with women and he's hooking up with aliens and all this. It's like, and if you really break it down, it's not that often, guys. It gets completely exaggerated. So is that something that you thought as well before you sat down and looked at it? Or did you know already that this is a trope that is incorrect?
No, thank you, Zach. You said it perfectly. In fact, there's only, I'd say, maybe 2-3 books. One, you know, the biggie, pocketbook official, you know, a big book that dealt anything with sexuality. And that one, of course, is called Captain Kirk's Women. It's very fun. It's a breezy sort of photo book. You know, I remember back in the day, I was like, maybe going to pick it up. You know, I think it's like 10, 15 years old. The point is that exactly what you said. It is so kind of minimalistic, right, what Kirk's done. Though, I mean, he's become almost like this galactic Lothario because, like, the reputation has spread more, I think, right? And it sort of fed on itself, right? But when you really look at the episode, you look at the whole crew having a real mature sexuality, a mature romance.
Yeah, I mean, he would often use his charms to the ends of helping his crew, you know, in episodes like like Cat's Paw, right? He's like trying to seduce Sylvia there, but I mean, he has no intention there. Of course, she picks up on it pretty quick and turns on him, but you know, he's using the tools at his disposal to help him and his crew out of bad situations.
Come on. Thank you. You know, the gangsters of Triskelion, I just love that name. Years ago, I used to pronounce it Triskelion, and it was just Triskelion. I just love the title. It's such a fun episode. And of course, the idea of him, you know, romancing, you know, the female warrior thrall and all. It's like, right, and at the end, and I mentioned in the book, like, it is such a poignant end. I think it's one of the most poignant sort of romantic ends. And, you know, we know, like you're saying, Kirk was just, it was a means to an end to get away. But you see her looking up, and it's, wow, it's such a great crane shot, too, if you recall. I love that scene.
That is funny because I've seen that clip used out of context, and it's absolutely hilarious. Not the end clip, but a clip from that episode where he kisses her and then knocks her out.
Yes, there you go. Yeah.
Out of context, that's one of the funniest things on this show.
Right. He's like Bond, and then, you know, all these tough guys like, I, you know, take women, and, you know. And that's the thing, too. It's funny seeing, even bringing up Bond, like the 60s, right? You know, that sort of transition from the more buttoned down, you know, Harriet Nelson, Leave It to Beaver 50s, right, into the more, you know, expressive 60s and 70s. Yeah, and that's where Star Trek Range shines. And in fact, when you think of it, it's on the cusp, right, because it's the late 60s going into the early 70s. So I love, you know, those ideas of like the transition of that culture and decades, you know?
Yeah, just great.
You know, it was cutting edge at the time. It really was. I mean, even the costumes are very suggestive, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing. Like, I literally thought, you know, it wouldn't be my thing. I mean, I do like costumes, but I'm like, you could do a book on just the costumes. You really could. Like, costumes, makeup, props. You could just do a whole thing. And I know they've done, there's probably a couple of them. I know there's a great The Art of Star Trek. That's an awesome hardcover book. And, yeah, but really, you could just take that alone through the lens of sexuality, right, or the lens of expressiveness, you know, of alien races or, you know, alien cultures, right? And they just nailed it. You know, I look at all the other incarnations of sci-fi, and Trek is still kind of head and shoulders above the rest, you know, in many ways, and, of course, certainly even visually and production-wise. It's still incredible.
Yeah, and, you know, because they had to conform to broadcast television standards at the time, I feel like they had to be a lot more clever and suggestive about things, which leads to, you know, opens the door for you to write books like this, because this stuff has not been delved into, you know, because today, like, today it's all on the screen, right? You watch like Westworld or something. Oh, well, there it is, right?
You know? Oh, I can't wait. You know, I've only seen clips. I can't wait to actually watch that show. Thank you for reminding me.
There you go.
That's on my watch.
Put it on the list.
Because I love the old one.
The best, and this is cliche, right, when you compare these things, but it's like old Battlestar Galactica and new Battlestar Galactica, right? But like amped up, right?
Exactly.
But I find, you know, I just find that refreshing in the way that Star Trek is, it's a family show. Right. And you can watch it. But, you know, like I said, we watched it at very, very young ages. Right. And you're not going to sit your 4-year old down to watch, you know, HBO's Game of Thrones or Westworld. Right. And the same way you can watch Star Trek. So that's actually something that I appreciate about the original series, is how under the surface a lot of these themes are, and that we can sit as nerds and talk about them and analyze them and write books about them and all that stuff. Because episodes like The Man Trap. Right. That's really a creepy situation. If you really stop and think
Zach,
about it.
You just hit on one of my favorites. The San Francisco Book Review, when they reviewed my book, they said The Man Trap was by far the most, you know, profound and sort of, you know, stimulating entry. Exactly. And I say the idea of having this partner that could be anything. Like, who wouldn't maybe want that? It'd be kind of creepy and weird, but wow, you could go to bed with anyone you wanted every night. Yeah. But they'd be an alien and they'd suck salt. They could soul vampire, but yeah. So there's pros and cons.
Pros and cons.
So, yeah. There you go. But exactly. I mean, thank you. That is one of the, in so many ways, right, Zach? That's one of the most creepy, haunting, you know, interesting, stimulating. It's everything that Star Trek was meant to be. I know some people say, oh, it's kind of a beastie of the week. I don't agree, right? If you really watch that and, you know, Nancy Crater and Bones, it's so poignant. It's so interesting. Yeah. It's got a lot more depth than just the monster of the week.
Yeah, it gets a bad rap, and on the surface, absolutely, it looks like just a generic monster of the week episode, as you said. But because of all the emotional elements, and then of course McCoy, and then the Dr. Crater, and all that, like there's some. If you really want, like, examine what's going on there, like this is weird. This is unsettling. So
yeah, it's incredible. Just imagine if, like, in a softer, gentler moment, if Spock and Kirk, you know, or what is it, McCoy, of course, you know, has to take her down. If they could have, like, taken her, maybe studied her, and she, you know, like the idea, like, shape shifting could have helped the friend. You know, I mean, right, so many things go in your mind. And sadly, it was like with the last of the species, the last of the race. Just so poignant, so emotional, you know. And then, you know, that suit was Wild Shang, I'm pretty sure, you know, who did the phasers and the tricorders. Yeah. So you look at that and you're like, wait a minute, you know, this is amazing work. He was a great artist. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually did a recent episode on the monsters and creatures of Star Trek, and we talked about the. Now, do you call it the salt vampire, or do you call it the M113 creature?
You know, very good. I think I said both in my entry. Yes, you know, because obviously the salt vampire is such a great generic thing. But really, it's so poignant. Remember, what is it? One of the crew members and looking at her, and of course she's appearing at younger or just a totally different girl. And you're like, even though you're creeped out, like you feel sorry to. It's trying to survive. It's trying to get over. You know, it could die, and it's just so good. I love it. It's one of my favorites.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, what are some others that, I mean, obviously you did like 40, entries here that you examine, what are some others that like really stick out to you as stuff that, that nobody really talks about enough? But like, you know what, guys, look underneath the surface. There's some good stuff here.
Yeah. You know, I'd say, I mean, even though it's one of the most, you know, popular, of course, is I love City on the Edge of Forever. You know, and I think there's so many, you know, and it's, I know it's been dissected so much. But I think you look at that, and I think basically I was saying the idea of the lost, you know, romance of maybe Bones, the idea of, what is it, the idea of, you know, doing the right thing. You have to do this for your future, for your family, and every, you know, at the end, he's like, yeah, you got it, let's get the hell out of here, you know. I think one of my proudest, I think, too, would be maybe Turnabout Intruder. You know, because, come on, you look at our society now and sexuality, the, you know, LGBTQ, you know, this is where we are now. You know, thank God we've, you know, totally opened up. And there's, you know, it's not just this one sexuality. And I think with Turnabout, even though, again, I know it gets a bad rap, and I tried to kind of save it or you know, cheerlead it a bit more to say, this is really interesting. The way he acts, I know people say, oh, Shatner did a little over femmy or whatever. I don't really think it's that bad. You know, I think for the time, of course, you know, they're trying to get what? A true, you know, contrast, right? I mean, if he had just gone around and said, you know, I'm still Captain Kirk and asking and acting totally masculine, I don't think, you know, that's, there's no clues there. So you have to, you know, give, yeah. So, and I think the idea of, you know, you can almost, I compared it to sort of a transgender almost, you know, like she becomes, you know, of him and vice versa. And it's like, you know, dueling sort of, you know, gender bodies, opposite bodies. So, you know, I mean, of course, you have to scratch a little bit more and see that. But I guess I do and I try. So, yeah.
Well, that's what's so interesting when you delve into these episodes that are 50 years old now. Right. As you said, everybody talks about, and we bounce back and forth between the classics, the heavy hitters, right? Or the more obscure ones that nobody talks about, or the ones that people give a bad rap to. And I find it more interesting to delve into, like, yeah, let's talk about Turnabout Intruder sometime, you know? Because nobody talks about it. Like, look, I love City on the Edge Forever. I love the Doomsday Machine. Yeah. I love all those episodes. But what else can be said about them at this point, right?
Thank you. Right. It is a little hard. And I think for me, it's funny, when I wrote each entry, you know, I tried to give at least a page and a half, two, whatever. I would like to have gone on. But then I said to myself, I don't want this to just become wiki. You know, I want it to become Memory Alpha, because if you go, those sites are amazing. And they, you know, they list and bullet list and document everything about an episode. That's not what I was trying to do, right? But when I looked at City on the Edge, I'm like, wow, I think I did like 1.5, maybe 2 pages. I'm like, well, I didn't say much. But I think, right, you said, right, everything's kind of been said and done. And then I think I summed that up by saying no episode in any of the incarnations, to me, gets that romance down. You know, like you look at Joan Collins, you know, in her prime, you know, with William Shatner, and it's just, it's glorious. You know, it's one of the best sort of examples of romance. Star Trek sex, Star Trek love, right? But like you're saying, it's not particularly, you know, novel anymore, right? Nothing, you know, everyone's brought something to it, exactly.
Now, do you read any Star Trek novels, like fiction novels?
Yeah, you know, I did. I used to. I haven't in a while. A good friend of mine literally has, George, he has read every one a couple times. He has lists. I think he's a site who's going to put one up. So he kind of turned me on a bit. A friend in high school did too. So I've read maybe several dozen. Yeah, I used to love them. I haven't in a while, though. But they're wonderful. I love the novels. Yeah,
I bring that up because there was a 40th anniversary. Now, this is like 10 years ago now, right? But for the 40th anniversary of Star Trek, they had a trilogy of novels called Crucible. So Star Trek Crucible, and they all revolved around the City on the Edge of Forever. And one
really?
Was a McCoy book, one was a Spock book, and one was a Kirk book. And it really delved into how that event influenced all their lives, and especially, you know, Kirk and his relationship with Edith Keeler. And it kind of extrapolates that they were in the 30s for a long time, right? The episode, it's kind of hard to gauge how long they were there, right? But, you know, I like to think they were there for, you know, maybe a couple months, maybe even more, you know, waiting around because they get an apartment, they get a job, right? It's not like they show up and then, like, 2 days later, McCoy shows up. I know in the truncated television world, that's how they have to portray it. But, you know, they can really delve into a lot of things, and you kind of feel like you feel the relationship, you feel the loss more. And I really recommend those books. If I don't read that many Star, I mean, when I was younger, I had more time and I read a lot of Star Trek novels.
Me too, right? I used to devour them now, right? As you get old, right? Exactly.
Yeah. But I definitely seek those out. So Star Trek Crucible.
Oh, yeah. That sounds awesome. I love the idea of almost like a Rashomon effect, right? Like perspective, multiple perspectives.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. That's why it's very fascinating to look at it. But
yeah, and in fact, come on, Zach, not just because we're fans, not because we're talking Trek, but name a show or a movie series. Okay, Star Wars. I know they're always kind of, you know, paralleling, but that has had that much true, you know, literature and books, really good novels. I mean, I challenge anyone, right, to read some of those books, exactly, and say these aren't really good just sci-fi novels, you know, really good sci-fi fantasy genre, whatever, right? And it's like, yeah, so it's another reason why Star Trek's so special, yeah, to have all those novels, all those books, too, yeah.
And I think that they, you know, this is a tangent, but that's what we do here, standard orbit tangents, as we say. That's what I like about the Star Trek expanded universe or extended universe. I don't know what these things are called anymore. I've heard so many terms. They don't have to worry about being canon, you know? I feel like there's such an obsession now with all these tie-ins of like, oh, you have to read the comic book before you watch the movie, and then get the fruit roll up in the cereal box. Whatever,
yeah,
right?
The holographic cereal thingamajig. I know, it's crazy.
Like, The Matrix, I think, started that really, like with the Animatrix and all these stuff, and I'm like, come on, guys.
I remember buying, I was working in the city, I was working PR firm in the city, and I bought the Animatrix, and I got it from the old Circuit City, yeah, and I was all crazed on my lunch hour, right? Yeah, exactly.
Circuit City, and now we're dating ourselves, yeah. Right?
Remember? Oh God! You know, I still think, believe me, I think they're online. You know, like they haven't dissolved. No more brick and mortar, but they're still online or something. Yeah.
Ultimately, Will, like, what do you hope readers will take away from your analysis here, in your book of all these episodes?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think, you know, you don't want another, like I said, even in, I think in the foreword, I said, you know, this is not another compendium, you know, this is not another database, you know, and wiki. Again, those things are great, but it's kind of been done to death, or it's all there and it's wonderful. I want to make you look at them again, and, you know, in a romance way, in a sex way, in a human sexuality way. I think, just recently I did, it was great, Trek News, who I'm writing for now, too. I do a special TNG F30 column. But they interviewed me, you know, before I came on board. And they said, you know, the writer said about the episodes. And I said, you know, yeah, let people look at this in a new way, you know, a different perspective. And kind of, you know, and not just look at it as, you know, just a adventure, sci-fi adventure show, which is great. A sociological show, which is great. But that human sexuality, right? And I think what's interesting, when people say, oh, sex sells and it's everywhere, it's like, yeah, but what kind of sex? Like you said, great point. Family values, or rather family show. It's funny, I've been doing a lot of old retro TV. I did a couple seasons of I Dream of Jeannie, Bewitched, you know, classic sitcoms. And as you know, right, they're in the same era as Trek. In fact, so many of the guest stars overlapped in Star Trek. You see some of the directors and writers on each. It's amazing. And it's like, you know, they're dealing with what? Sci-fi, fantasy, genre, whatever. And they always skirt, right? They always get close to maybe a little bit of too raunchy sex, but never, right? They never have to be, you know, the X rating, right? So just to look at these episodes again, these characters, and yeah, that they're human beings, and hey, human beings need love, right? Human beings need relationships and love. Yeah.
Absolutely.
One of the reviewers said it should be maybe called Star Trek Love or Star Trek Romance, because that's what it really is in a way. But you know, Star Trek sex, it's a quick, you know, pithy.
As you said, sex sells. So there you have it.
Yeah. There you go.
now you mentioned the Next Generation, and you know, the original series is not your only Star Trek wheelhouse. You're one of a select group of freelance writers who actually sold scripts to Next Generation and Deep Space Nine that were produced back in the days of Star Trek's open script submission policy. So I mean, first of all, legit, man. kudos to you, sir. Tell us about how that came about and your experiences there.
You know, it still kind of blows my mind, seriously. I mean, I'm not just saying that, because back in the day, right, I mean, like we were saying before, the idea of so many ways to watch TV, right, movies, Roku and streaming on your phone, on your tablet. And back then, what, it was only, you know, the broadcasting, what, you had syndicated TV shows, yeah, and you had cable. But, right, to think that Michael Piller, you know, he's passed now, great producer, of course, the best of both worlds, Locutus, you know, creator, he opened up the show. Yeah, he opened up the show, I think it was 91 or 92. And in 93, that's when mine was purchased. I found out about the script open policy. And I actually, I bought the book by Larry Nemchek, The Star Trek Companion, you know, Star Trek Generation Companion. And I'll never forget the entry. It was the episode Clues. And I can almost verbatim. I said, Bruce D. Arthur's proved it could be done. The Arizona postal carrier and Star Trek fan wrote a spec script and submitted it and it was purchased. And as soon as I saw that, like, again, it's burned in my brain. I'm like, I'm going to do this.
I did.
Yeah. It's incredible. And then I looked, you know, obviously I finished the book, so excited. I wrote to Larry because I got maybe 22 or more, you know, photo flubs and errors, you know, wrong caption, whatever. And I'm like, yeah, he's going to appreciate this, right? But he did because, you know, pocketbooks, and I'm sure they, you know, they did appreciate it. And he said, hey, Will, you know, this is the deal. This is how you can get, you know, maybe your script in, but be assured. I think he said at that time there was 5,000 a week or something, I don't know, a month that they would be inundated with. He said, don't, you know, be upset if you don't, yours doesn't get bought. And yeah, it was awesome. And, you know, that's another thing. Larry wrote, writing back to me, and he gave me the name of Lolita Fatchow, the script coordinator. You know, and you had to go through her to get the guidelines and all. You know, again, it's one of those things that I probably wouldn't have gotten the contact. I would have had to get it some other way. So it was really, really helpful.
No, Larry's an awesome guy. We've had him on Standard Orbit and met him at Star Trek Las Vegas last year. So he's a great guy. That's awesome that he helped you out that way. And what Trek fan does not have his Next Generation companion on their shelf, right? That's like required required purchase.
Right. I got the two volumes, right? The blue one that I bought in back in the day, of course, and then the expanded one. And then, of course, then I saw my name in it. You know, I went to Homeward, and there's, you know, Will Stape, one of the writers. I mean, to see writers and have my name. Zach, I don't care what else I do. I mean, I want to do a lot more in my life. But having to be connected with Star Trek, it'll always be a thrill. You know, that dream come true. Yeah.
Speaking of, you know, you wrote the episode Homeward, contributed to the story. What was your inspiration there? How did you come up with the idea for that episode?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, for sure, I was sort of combing, you know, my brain, the databanks there, to see what has not been explored. So I said, hey, you know, let me look at each, you know, character and see their, you know, their spotlight stories, right? The episode thing would all have, there'd be a Troy episode or a Worf episode. And in this case, of course, it was Heart of Glory. It's first season. And so I'm looking all over my old episodes. I'm like, there you go. And they mention Worf's foster brother. And they say about him, you know, his upbringing. He goes, you know, my brother, you know, Starfleet Academy, but he hated it. And that's all he said. It was like one line, maybe two lines. And I said, damn, that's a huge opportunity to flesh that out, to delve into that. Right. And I actually named after my good friend Joe. I named him Joe Rozhenko, but they changed it. Obviously Russian. But yeah, it was one of those things, Zach, right? Well, you know, it's like, you go over episodes, you want to watch them again and again for whatever reason. My reasoning, of course, was the research, you know, to stimulate myself, to get ideas, but to just, you know, wade in the Trek pool.
It's interesting that you had a freelance idea that came into the seventh season, because I often call Star Trek The Next Generation the seventh season, like Star Trek The Family Reunion, right? Because there seems to be a family member coming in every other episode.
Zach, I was so lucky. Think about it, because who knows? I mean, I haven't actually confirmed, but when they got mine, right, and I don't know, whoever was working, right, on maybe the Data's mom episode, the Geordi's mom, exactly, and they all kind of came to, yeah, it became like the family reunion, exactly, yeah. Who knows, if I had submitted it 3 years before, maybe they would have liked it, yeah, wouldn't care.
Yeah, well, they were probably going through the same process you did, like, okay, guys, we got 6 years in the bank, we got one more to do, what left is there out there we can find? So they went back and they found, you know, they went to the battle and found Damon Vok and all that stuff.
Thank you. You're so good. You're good. I love it. Yeah.
Now, you know, and we talk about here a lot on Trek FM. Like, I think a lot of people write off the first couple years of Next Gen because they don't have the callers. And yeah, they're kind of hit or miss. But I think there's still a lot of entertainment and enjoyment to be had in those early seasons.
I'm telling you, I just did my first article, my special column, TNG at 30, with over Trek News. And my editor, Brian Wilkins, great guy. But what I'm saying is he motivated me to do my first article, like, what is Next Gen to you? Like, you know, give us the jumping off point, the springboard. Zach, and it's amazing because just what you said, right? I literally go through it and say, watch the first season. This is not that bad. You know, in fact, it's really damn good, right? I mean, you know, right? You look at these jumping off points. Not only that, but look, you look at Troy and Riker. The whole, like, I'll never forget it, right? When they meet on the bridge and Picard's like, oh, you know, and they drone out, you know, mute Picard because she starts doing the you know, telepathy. Imzadi, do you remember what I taught you? I mean, that's just, I still get chills on that. that. It's such a beautiful, you know, coming together of characters and that arc of theirs. Yeah. So you, I like to say you gotta, of course, do the first to get to the last, right? You can't have the last without the first. That's ridiculous. In fact, with a lot of the DVD sets, I would love them to do like a pilot and you know, the last episode, like say A Counter of Far Point and All Good Things, like, you know, sort of combo things. That way you get the first and the last. Yeah. So.
Another script you sold was Profit Motive for Deep Space Nine's third season. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Definitely. And I'll tell you the original title. My original title was Charity. And it's funny, and again, like we're saying, getting ideas for things. I mean, it was a no-brainer to do something with, you know, Quark, I love, you know, the Ferengi. And then I said, well, obviously the idea of, you know, the penny pinching and, you know, the financially obsessed Ferengi, and what would be their darkest hour? Well, if the leader came and said, we're going to turn it into a charity, and everyone's going to give away your money. Like, are you kidding me? You know. So that's basically, it was one of those sort of no-brainers, and I fleshed out more. But my my original character was not the Negus. It was like a, you know, a new guy that was almost challenging the Negus, you know. He was actually, I named him, it's so funny how you get names. At the time, Perot, you know, Ross Perot was running, you know, the big indie guy. You know, hey, you vote for me, how you doing, you know. So I was watching him in CNN with Larry King back in the day, and I'm like, oh my God, I'll kind of patterned him after Ross Perot. So I named him, instead of Perot, I did, of course, a backwards, I Torep, you know, I just reversed the mirror, the name. It's a kind of cool name, I think. So Torep was my dude. And then, of course, I mean, Negus is perfect. To have Wallace Shawn and to have, you know, in my episode, fucking again. I mean, I got lucky enough to have, you know, I say I gave Worf a brother or helped. And I tried to give a charity to the Ferengi. And Paul Sorvino, who's, you know, the actor who played Nick, he's got a new cookbook out with his wife. He's doing the rounds. I love Paul. Goodfellas, one of my favorite actors. You know, in fact, he did a TV movie with LeVar Burton back in the day. I think it's called Dummy. It's about deaf mutes, and Paul played a deaf mute lawyer, and LeVar Burton played like a guy, you know, accused of murder, and he was a deaf mute too. What I remember when I was like 10, 12 years old, it's a great film. So it's interesting they had that little, you know, next gen.
Well, little did you know he would be saying your dialogue one day down the road, right?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's this is a, and you know, I mean, him and then Patrick Stewart. I'm like, man, you know, Patrick Stewart, Picard, Ocean, Luke, you know, come on. I mean, it's just, I mean, look what he's done, Zach. I mean, come on. It's like he's still the rarefied air, you know, A-lister doing Logan and just amazing.
Right.
I'm so into it. Yeah.
Did they send you tapes before the episode aired? Or did you have to wait like the rest of us and watch it all over the broadcast?
Yeah. You know what's funny? It's one of those things I'll never forget too, and I'll never forget her help as DC Fontana. Like I like to say, you know, Lucille Ball was sort of the mother of Star Trek, and DC Fontana was definitely one of the great women of Star Trek too. You know, literally almost helping to create Spock or his backstory. You know the deal. Everyone knows.
Right.
So I wrote to DC. You know, Dorothy Fontana. She was either head of the Writers Guild, I think she was, or vice president. She was definitely on the board. I think she was the head. And I wrote to her and I said, look, you know, I'm a total newbie. I'm a total wet behind the ears, more than I can say. Can you please give me maybe guidance? I thought she'd write back, whatever. She called me. I remember on Halloween. You know, you don't forget these things. And it's like, hi, you know, William Sapiens? I'm like, yeah. And she's like, Dorothy Fontana. I'm like, oh my God. And I was total fanboy. She's like, just shut up. I mean, polite. And she's like, I got to talk to you. Okay. Like, okay. And we just talked. And she said about how the credits would go and stuff. But one thing she told me, always remember, Zachary, ready? When she did, I believe it was called Dax, right? One of the Deep Space Nine episodes. I don't think she has any other writing credits of DS9. Obviously, in Next Gen, we're getting counted on all. But she said, Will, I said about, you know, getting the, like you said, a tape or, you know, a heads up. She goes, I don't know. She goes, they sent me the script, I think, a month after it aired or something. And then I knew it, then it aired or something. She goes, I had no kind of heads up. So I was like, wow, if DC Fontana is treated like that, yeah. I guess it should, you know, I can't be complaining. Yeah. But I guess it's just, it's such a business. It's such a, you know, and there's so many things happening, you know, who knows? Yeah. But I got the writer's credits, you know, like what it will read. And then they kept calling me. They said, oh, okay, what do you want your writer's credit to read? I said, oh, I wanted to read William Stape, whatever, and Stape, and I wanted to put my initial in there, whatever. She's like, okay, whatever. And then I remember once, ready? How naive, right? Once they called and they said, blah, 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 again, what your writer's credit. I said, could it read story by? And they're like, no, you know, because that's a different level of pay, and I have to pay you a lot more. And it's like, no, I'm sorry. So that was, little naivete, a little bit, you know.
That's interesting. Yeah, you're right. If Dorothy Fontana's not getting tapes, really, I don't think you should expect any either. So,
I'm telling you, my friend. And, you know, you look at other things. Here's another one. Like, I could go on and on all day about Next Gen, and obviously you don't mind. Now, there's a writer-producer. It was in the fifth or sixth season. He co-wrote Chain of Command, Frank Abbatamarco.
Right. Wasn't he a lawyer of some kind?
I'm telling you. It's hard to get info in him, right? Because I tried, because I love his work. Remember, he also did Man of the People, you know, the wig out Troy. I love that episode.
I don't like that episode.
Really? All right. Well, we're gonna beg to differ. But the point is like he did make such an impact. Like if you see those episodes, right? And you really don't like hear about his contribution, right? I don't know. It's weird. You go to his IMDb, it's kind of truncated. Yeah. So I'm just saying, like, the idea of, like, you know, these, you know, so many people have contributed, and even some of the producers on staff, and you're not, you know, you don't know. So why don't you like the episode?
I find it another episode in a long line of Troy's a victim episodes. It's like, we're gonna turn her powers against herself, and oh, there we go. Yeah, and then just, and the age makeup's pretty cheesy, and...
Yeah, that is, I'll give you that. But I wrote an article back in the day, Troy, you know, Next Gen's favorite victim, right? I just went to everyone's... But I kind of laugh at it because I totally agree with the cheapo makeup and all. But there's something not only about her performance, you know, it's so raw and so like in your face, but like the idea of, like, you know, having this gem, and yeah, you could say it's another just, you know, gadget and thingamajig that steals energies and all, but there was something it worked for me. And I think Curtis, you know, when she was at her top, she was incredible. So yeah. I think one of the real tops is it The Loss? I love
that
one.
Yes, where she loses her powers, yes.
Yeah, that's a beauty. I mean, in all ways. Again, we can go on and on by what Trek was done in terms of awards. You know, it was Emmy nominated in the last season. But there was so many great times that I think Next Gen and Deep Space Nine just got to such a height in drama. And, you know, was not given.
Yeah, deal, in so. Season 7, I felt like it was, you had a good run. Here's a nomination. We know you're going off the air.
Right. It's like, we didn't recognize it, but here's your little bone, your little consolation prize. Agreed. I know. Yeah. But it would be nice if it had won.
Getting back to your episode, I did have a question. Since you wrote Homeward, what do you think happened to Worf's brother and his family there? Because obviously we never revisited them for the rest of Star Trek.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, who knows? I was waiting for, maybe Deep Space Nine or something else. Well, yeah, Voyager was in Lost in Space. But right, to maybe, revisit them in some way. Maybe something happened. Maybe they found something that was cool that the Federation needed. But then again, that could have been like Insurrection, the Briar Patch. I don't know if we want to go there again. No. But yeah, it's interesting. I think Penny Johnson and the actress is so good. As the love and the
Cassidy Yates.
Yeah, I'm telling Cassidy Yates. And to see her back, Zach, how lucky am I? I know. To have these actors all, you know, within my Next Gen of Deep Space Nine, to keep kind of recurring their big names and they're respected. I know. But yeah, I would say they're just really happy. Maybe they don't, you know, they don't want to be bothered anymore because they're so happy on their new digs.
Well, the creative behind Star Trek Insurrection obviously liked your idea since they kind of copied and pasted it.
It's really interesting. I think I remember someone telling me that and saying, wow, you know, blah, 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 and stuff. I know that, right. It's such a potent thing, the idea of replicating or the illusions and the holographic replication. I'm surprised they didn't do it kind of more. I mean, I know they did Star Trek Voyager, they had Spirit Folk. I mean, that was reversed. That was holographic figures becoming sentient. And I was like, you know, whatever, raising my eyebrows here. I mean, you know, there were some interesting issues you could raise with the dock and all. But I think with Voyager to go a little bit off track, they relied a little bit too much on holodeck. You know, I want to see flesh and blood. I want to see, you know. But you could argue that if you're lost in space like that, what are you going to do? You know, you got the holodecks. You're going to use it more. Yeah, so.
Well, there was an episode of Voyager called Flesh and Blood, ironically about holograms. So.
There you go. And that's one of the better ones. And I think, right, it's funny what time does, Zach, right? Back in the day, I'm watching that, and I'm all kind of like, oh, I don't know, and too much holographic stuff. Now, what do we have? We're on the cusp of virtual reality. It pretty much is here, you know, affordable. I was looking at something the other day. They said this new VR, I can't remember the name, but they said it's stunning. The hosts were like, you know, tripping over themselves trying it. And they said, you are at the beach, or you are at the Grand Canyon, or you are at, you know, in Paris.
And it's like, so it's here, right? So maybe I'm wrong saying that you know, HR or holography and VR rather is going to be just huge, and people are going to use it more than we should, maybe, yeah, become addicted like Barkley.
Right.
We're all going to be running around like Barkleys, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, if there really were holodecks, I mean, we're not to the 21st century level of evolved human that Star Trek claims to have, right? We would all be Barkley in the holodeck. I mean, let's be honest, right?
Literally, we'd never come out. We'd Domino's, Chinese delivery. And just leave it there.
So if you eat in the holodeck, like, do you keep those calories when you leave? Question.
You know, exactly. And then, didn't you love, I used to be so geeky into, of course, the tech. And I bought, of course, Rick Sternbach's, Michael Kuda's, the Next Gen Tech Manual. And they said how it would, reuse the, wink, wink, reuse all the food and the wink, wink, waste, whatever. And the idea of like re-replicate that. And it was all cleaned up, of course. But right, it's like you go in there and don't you love when they would bring out stuff and then it would take like 2 seconds to dissolve, right? Or 5 seconds, and it would just start to and go. It's so drama, because come on, how could it even pass the threshold? Well, maybe, but it's just...
So much. Yeah. There's so many rabbit holes you can go down talking about Star Trek. So yeah, you should totally. Do you have any plans to write Star Trek Sex 2? Talking about Next Generation, maybe.
Yeah, I would like to tackle it. I mean, my publisher's totally game. I think, yeah, I would love. And in fact, I had to restrain myself. And as you reading the book and knowing it, I do delve into, a bit of Next Gen and even Deep Space Nine. Yeah, I touch on it. And I think, but to really explore that, like really Man of the People. I mean, the perfect mate. I mean, you look at that.
Oh, yeah, lots of stuff there.
That almost gets close to sitting on the edge, because you got Patrick Stewart, Famke Jensen in her prime. I mean, it's almost like a mirror. Another beautiful people in this beautiful of story. And remember how gracious and graceful and amazing she was. And that's, if I recall, that's her first real role. I think she did maybe TV commercials or maybe something minor. But that's her first like big dramatic role coming over from Europe. And I was like, this actress, it blew my mind. I'm like, she's going to be a huge, and she became Jean Grey and Phoenix and whatever, yeah.
And Xena Onatopp in Goldeneye, one of my favorite Bond girls.
Definitely, so. That's where I saw her before, but like, exactly. And that too, when I saw her, I'm like, damn, it's like Trek scores again, a big name, and she's a great actress. And we're so blessed, really. The casting directors, Rick Berman, everyone who cast Trek, come on, right? It's amazing. I know they saw Patrick Stewart, I think, at a Shakespeare reading or some, dramatic reading, and that's how they got him for Picard. What was he in? Dune, right?
I think Dune. And he was in a very minor role in Excalibur as well with Liam Neeson. Both of them were minor roles. So,
yeah.
It is fun to go back and look at that. Well, Will, I want to thank you for taking all your time to talk to us today about your book and also your other Star Trek experiences. And, if people want to find you online and keep track of your work, where can they find you and where can they find the book, Star Trek Sex?
Yeah, it's pretty much everywhere. Online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And, you just, go online, order. You can get the Kindle, too, of course, or the iTunes, the Apple version of the Kindle, yeah. And now I'm writing for Trek News, and that's a real blast. Yeah, it's like doing primarily TNG at 30, the great sort of anniversary. But I just do, regular Star Trek, too. But, yeah, that's on treknews.net. Great site.
Well, thanks again. And, the sexuality of Star Trek isn't the only thing we've been discussing this week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at what you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
All right, I'll tell you what. I have never, ever, ever worn a costume or cosplayed or anything like that. Now the challenge, the gauntlet has been out there. We're going to have to put together a Mugatu costume.
Mugatu costume.
We got to.
To the journey!
Make him taller. Give him some salt and pepper gray hair.
Yeah. Make those shoulders broader.
Computer, put a tattoo over his left eye. Oh my god, look what I just did!
I made a Chakotay.
Warp 5.
Are you an outside entity that is watching you deal as the bad archer with the good archer? And Scott just looks at me and turns around and goes, oh, God, will someone come here and get Gary a strip?
Meta Treks.
But these Romulans are still walking around in those nasty pointy shoulder tunics that they wear. I mean, what's up with that?
Doesn't seem like they shed as much of their identity as the Klingons
did. Yeah, not shedding as much of their identity.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, get the show on iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app. Be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. If you would like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at Trek FM, Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on the content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And speaking of Patreon, thank you as always to our associate producers for Standard Orbit: Renee Roberts, Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, Tim Robertson, Nick Anastasio, and Richard Marquez. Thank you so much for all of your support for both Standard Orbit and Trek.fm through Patreon. You can find Renee on Twitter at @mres_1701, Norm on Twitter at @starfighter1701, Aaron on Twitter at @geekfilter, and Tim on Twitter at @timrobertson56. And Nick and Richard aren't on Twitter, but you can find them on Facebook and around the Babel Conference. As for me personally, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach, that's MoreonZach. And you can find my other podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. And we cover the Young Superman show, Smallville, that ran from 2001 to 2011 on the WB and the CW. So thanks everyone for listening, and join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.